Civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. preached nonviolence as the way to fight social and racial injustice. He was assassinated 46 years ago today. Was King's philosophy correct? Is nonviolent protest the way to bring about social change? Is nonviolence effective? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, April 4th. Our guest writes a blog for Psychology Today on race, culture, and community. And he also wrote an article on the psychology of nonviolence, which he says is needed more than ever because of the violence in society today. And we'll wonder what you think. Is nonviolence effective? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Mikhail Lubansky, a member of the teaching faculty in the Department of Psychology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He wrote an article for Psychology Today, Is Nonviolence Effective? And he joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you for having me on. I'm a big fan of public radio.
Well, thank you so much. It's good to have you. Well, let's just get started. What are your thoughts today on this being the 46th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, who preached nonviolence, yet his life ended in a very violent way.
Yeah, ironic, isn't it? Mm. I think Dr. King was a real hero. He started to lead the movement as a very young person. He was just 26 when he took leadership of the Montgomery bus boycott, and he did so in part because of his tremendous capacity to organize and lead, but in part because some of the elder people in the movement were reluctant to take on such a task. And he did it knowing that his life was at risk on a daily basis, and kept to his spiritual beliefs, kept to his moral ideals, and I think created one of the most important historical movements of our time.
Yeah, and why was he viewed as such a threat when he was a nonviolent man preaching nonviolence?
Well, he threatened the way of life in the South. He threatened the status quo. He threatened the establishment that went back to not just the Jim Crow establishment, but the racial hierarchy that this country was really built on and that had existed for several hundred years before he was born.
Help us understand what the principles of nonviolence from Martin Luther King's perspective. What exactly did that mean?
Well, it meant, first of all, that nonviolence was direct action, that it was a movement, that it was not an absence of something, but it was an organized, community, people-led movement in order to accomplish specific social justice goals, and that the methods of that movement would not use violence.
Mm-hmm. This piece that it was part of a chapter of a book that you participated in, Is Nonviolence Effective? I guess I was a little surprised reading this because there's actually a school of thought that violence is the way to go.
Well, I think I think there's the idea that, well, maybe smaller disputes, we can settle nonviolently. But the idea that if there is a regime in charge that is willing to use violence, then the only way to resist that regime, and so this was a different situation than what the civil rights movement faced in the U.S., but that the only way to resist a violent regime is to use violence. But the data, in fact, don't bear that out, and it's not even close, it turns out.
Yeah, well, talk a little bit about that. What evidence is there that nonviolence is the way to go?
Well, there have been two books written, one very recent, one a little bit older. The older book is called A Force More Powerful, and that book documents the nonviolent resistance of the 20th century, really focusing between 1966 and 1999, and they found that during this time, there were 67 transitions from authoritarianism, and 50 of those used nonviolent resistance as its primary strategy. But it's actually the most recent book that we kind of focus on in our chapter, and this is a book called Why Civil Resistance Works by Erica Chenoweth. And she actually engaged in so hers was a comparative study. She tried to identify every single struggle, every single regime change, both violent and nonviolent, and she found hundreds of cases all over the world. And the criteria was that there would have to be at least 1,000 participants. So any case that had at least that many people involved, she sort of counted. And then she looked at the outcomes, and she found that nonviolent methods were twice as likely to lead to regime change and also to sustained democratic change, that is, one that wouldn't then result in violence later on.
Can you look at Dr. Martin Luther King's nonviolent movement and say that it was successful in regime change, or at least changing our society?
Well, absolutely. I don't think the movement was designed to achieve a regime change. I don't think King or his followers wanted to topple the government, but they certainly wanted to topple the racial hierarchy and the set of laws that we come to know as Jim Crow, and they were very much successful in doing that. Civil rights legislation in the mid-1960s did away with Jim Crow, did away with legalized segregation, and I think for the first time there was at least by law true equality, and I think in practice we're still very much aiming to get there.
We are talking about nonviolence and whether nonviolence is the way to bring about social change. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It is 18 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, April 4th. Civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. preached nonviolence as the way to fight social and racial injustice. He was assassinated 46 years ago today. Was King's philosophy correct? Is nonviolence the way to bring about social change? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Mikhail Lubansky, who is a member of the teaching faculty at the Department of Psychology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is also co-author of the book Between the Lines, Toward a Socially Responsible Psychology for a Global Era. And we have lots of callers, Mikhail, who want to join in. But you also, in your writings, preach a nonviolent psychology. You think that we all should have this nonviolent psychology?
Joy, can I just correct you on the title of that book? I'm sorry. You combined the name of my blog and the name of the book all into one, but they're actually two different things.
Please do. Go ahead.
Sure. So my blog is called Between the Lines, and the name of the book is Toward a Socially Responsible Psychology for a Global Era.
That's okay. I'm going to blame Cynthia Schuster. She just said I could blame her. She's my producer. But I'm just kidding. Thank you. We'll make sure we don't say that again.
Sure. And I'm sorry, I was distracted by that. Could you repeat the question?
I said that you in your writings, you're talking about a non-violent psychology, and that you think that this is needed in such a violent society as we have today in the United States.
Sure. I mean, what I'd like to see is a lot more scholarship in the area of psychology. When I was a student, an undergraduate student and a graduate student, nonviolence was not something that came up in any single course that I took. And when we started to work on this on the book project and we started to work on the chapter, we obviously wanted to find the scholarship and the research on the topic, and there was incredibly little. You know, I'm telling you about some of the work that I found really moving, but it's actually work done outside of psychology, which is wonderful. But I really wanted to see psychologists get involved in the way that psychology has been studying violence and the effects of violence on children, on adults. I'd love to see school psychologists start to look at how nonviolence could be taught in schools, how children can learn nonviolent ways of solving their own conflicts, which they can later then transform to solving adult conflicts as they grow up. That was part of it.
Okay, yeah. Let's take some calls. Sure. Nick in Waukesha is with us. Hello, Nick.
Yes. I would like to say that ultimately, I know Martin Luther King was nonviolent, but it wasn't until a violent act was committed that serious change happens. So when you think of labor and you think of anything that happened in this country, even Malcolm X, it wasn't until violent acts were committed that people kind of opened their eyes and say, okay, change, you know, even though Martin Luther King led up to that with the nonviolence, it wasn't until the actual violence happened that people opened their eyes. And I feel that ultimately it comes down to violence in the end. And you can do nonviolence, but it isn't until the actual violence is committed after you've exhausted all of those things. I mean, it's why people riot, poor people, because they can, because there's no other choice. So they have to get power somehow. And I feel that the reason why a lot of the violence in our society is growing is because people are oppressed. And when people are oppressed, they want to get control. And violence is kind of like a last measure. And so I do think it definitely has significance in change.
Mikhail?
Well, I agree with Nick that violence—that's many forms of violence—are come from people's dissatisfaction with the society around them. You know, I think just as we raise our volume in our speech when we have the experience of not feeling heard, eventually even loud speech is insufficient if we still have the experience of not feeling heard. And I think that's when, you know, for some people, violence starts to come up as a strategy to be heard. And in that way, it can be an effective strategy. You know, if you raise the volume loud enough, people will pay attention. So on that point, I agree. I'm not sure which specific violent incidents Nick is thinking about.
I think he thinks the assassination, it took that to really bring the change about.
That's an interesting hypothesis. I was thinking that there was a lot of violence that was directed toward King, even before the assassination, of course, and toward his followers. And as I understand the movement, part of what made it so effective was that the TV cameras, which follow what was happening and took images of the dogs and the police officers attacking, you know, essentially nonviolent young people, and a lot of them were very young people, students, and in some cases even college students, but also high school students and even younger, that those images were so disturbing and so disturbed people's sense of morality and ethics that support for the movement grew.
Yeah. Well, I know it wasn't violence on the part of Martin Luther King or his supporters, or for that matter, the assassination of JFK. A lot of say that spurred action to pass the policies that he that he wanted. I mean, what do you think of that theory, that that violence is what brings about the change?
Well, as I understand, both Nick and you are kind of making the argument that it's the violence that is addressed against the nonviolent protesters that is the combination that produces change. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think it's one of the things that get public sympathy and public support. One of the things that Chenoweth argued that makes nonviolence so much more effective than violence is that it has much more capacity to attract large followers. So she pointed, her data showed that a movement that attracted 3.5% of the population was guaranteed to be successful. But only nonviolent movements were able to attract that high number.
Let's take some more calls. Rich in Rhinelander is with us. Hi, Rich.
Good morning. I explained to your screener that I was at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign when Martin Luther King was assassinated. I wasn't very high up on the teaching staff. I was a TA at that time, but there was a general milling around of students and faculty and the community, and I saw some of my students, and I wandered up to them, and I thought I was going to comfort them, and I said, "What are you thinking?" And they said, "Well, it's about time somebody did it," meaning got rid of Dr. King. And the reason for my call is I think frequently when we think about violence, we think about the physical end of violence. We'll talk about the murder rate in the inner city and that sort of thing. But we really don't pay attention to the other forms of violence that are perpetrated on people. And by that, I mean the economic violence against people, psychological violence against certain other groups of people, women and gays and men, too, in certain ways. But it's become very fashionable to talk of oneself as being nonviolent when basically all one does is maybe work at a soup kitchen or do some food pantry work once a month or every several months or whatever. And this is a country that spends an enormous number of dollars on training young people how to kill other people. Mm-hmm. And as Joan Baez says, if it's so natural to kill people, how come men have to go into training to learn how? And then when they come home, we praise them by saying, thank you for your service.
Mikhail.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with everything that he said. And, you know, I'm disappointed to hear about the little piece about the university. But we wrote about nonviolence much more broadly than you know, on the scale of nations. And one of the ways that we talked about violence is that it's the knowing, it's doing harm and having the awareness that you're doing it. And if you think about violence in that way, then we're all violent. I'm violent. I'm aware of having caused some harm in my household, in my family yesterday. And so part of what nonviolence means to me in that context is that when that happens, that I'm going to try to fix it, try to make it right. And that's part of the restorative justice orientation that to me is a large part of nonviolence.
Yeah, to talk a little bit more about that, we do have a news break coming up in a couple of minutes. How is restorative justice a part of this nonviolent philosophy?
Well, our conventional justice system, basically is a retributive system. We recognize that when a person causes suffering to another, that the way to create justice is to make that person suffer in turn. And we create that suffering primarily through incarceration, but, you know, there are other punitive measures. And prison is a pretty violent place. I mean, I think that just the act of taking your liberty, taking one's liberty away is violent, but also the, you know, what happens in prison is violent. And there's sort of, you know, and we think that that does justice. And of course, there's a notion that, you know, it's an eye for an eye, and as quote attributed to Gandhi, but probably originated elsewhere, if you keep going for an eye, then the whole world is left blind. And so we perpetuate violence in that way. So a restorative response says, rather than creating punishment for the person who did harm, let's restore the person or persons or community that was harmed. Let's lift them up instead, and let's create a set of obligations on the person or persons who created the harm, as well as possibly on the community that allowed that harm to happen. And then we can restore justice that way.
We are talking about nonviolence. Is nonviolence effective? Is it an effective way to bring about social change? We'll check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll be back. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about the power of nonviolence in a violent society this hour. On this day, 46 years ago, when civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 7:37 on this Friday, April 4th. We are talking with a guest who says nonviolence is the answer to overcoming violence. And nonviolent protests or movements or methods are more effective than violent uprisings in bringing about change. And we are welcoming your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Mikhail Lubansky. He is a member of the teaching faculty in the Department of Psychology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He writes the Between the Lines blog at Psychology Today, offering perspectives on race, culture, and community. He is also co-author of the book Toward a Socially Responsible Psychology for a Global Era. And we are talking with him about some of the ideas, the themes of a recent piece that he posted in his blog, Between the Lines, Is Nonviolence Effective? And the answer is yes. Well, we'll get back to more on the restorative justice piece of this conversation in just a few moments, but we have callers who've been waiting. Lyman in Janesville is with us. Hello, Lyman.
Hi, good morning, Joy. Good morning to your guests. Good morning to your listeners. You know, I have some, you know, despite the dubious news reporting of certain agencies, there are no palm trees in Madison. And those protests back in 2011 were, to my understanding, totally nonviolent. And unless I've missed something, completely ineffective at blocking any legislation or achieving its ends. I wonder what, and if you look at the Occupy movement, you see sort of similar results. I wonder if your guest might comment on what elements were missing from these movements that prevented them from being successful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any ideas, Mikhail?
Well, I'm not familiar with the local Wisconsin events, but to the degree that there's something that prevents nonviolent movements from being effective, it's probably the lack of a critical mass of participants. But I really can't comment any further about that. As far as the Occupy movement, it certainly had a very large critical mass, and I'm not sure that it was ineffective. The Occupy movement brought consciousness about the economic inequality, about poverty, about the accesses of the top 1%, you know, some of the things that one of your previous callers talked about. In a way that I think are part of our national discourse now in ways that they weren't prior to that movement.
Thank you, Lyman, for the call. Bernie in Elkhorn is with us. Hello, Bernie.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to make a point that I think is an important one, and that is that our government, our federal government, with the use of the military, sets the tone for violence in our culture. If you look historically, for example, Martin Luther King was very opposed to the Vietnam War. Right now, in Vietnam, there were 2 to 3 million people killed who lived in that part of the world on a war that was started on lies. That's exceeding violence, and yet in our culture, the debate is really about that the Vietnam vets get treated properly rather than examining what sort of sociopaths in government lead to such mass bloodshed. And today we have the same sort of thing. We have an invasion and occupation in Iraq, Afghanistan, built on lies. We have drones killing men, women, and children by the thousands. And yet our culture doesn't talk about it. And when it is talked about, it's always, well, the troops are heroes and we're fighting terror. And really, we're a purveyor of terror. And I believe that it sets the example that violence is the way to solve problems. And we always have leaders, whether it's Barack Obama or John McCain, who blab on about wanting peace while their actions are just the opposite.
Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree fully with that. And King's opposition to the Vietnam War was both on the grounds of, you know, him being against violence and that was being perpetrated in, you know, in America's name, but also because he thought it was an incredible injustice to devote those kinds of resources to war at the expense of the social justice work and poverty that could be done domestically. And I think he would have the very same point of view today.
Let's go next to Chris in Green Bay. Hello, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Kind of replying to the gentleman who called earlier about, you know, unsuccessfulness of nonviolence. And, you know, in Madison, back during the Act 10, when everybody was walking around the Capitol, Peter Yale said it best. And really, for nonviolence to be most effective, it does take decades, you know, not just a weekend movement or a summer of protesting, but it takes decades to make those changes. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, thanks very much, Chris. And you said you weren't familiar with the Madison protest, but it was, you know, a month or so of tens of thousands of people protesting at our state capitol, occupying our state capitol. It did get some worldwide attention with the Silent Spring protesters, you know, showing solidarity. But it was only about a month or so. Does it do you need more time than that?
You know, I'm sure that that's something that Chenoweth examined in her book, and I don't have a good feel for that. But one of the things I want to really underscore that your caller just said is just the idea of that it's not just effectiveness, it's also what we in our book described as fruitfulness in the same way that you plant a seed and it takes some time for that seed to grow, that there's sometimes effects, fruit of seeds planted through nonviolence that aren't evident for quite some time. And we tell several stories of how exactly that sort of thing happened.
Let's go to Ian in Wapaka now. Ian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to make a couple of points. One of them is I think somebody once said that humanity is not very good at resolving conflict with each other, and also somebody once said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. And I'll take my answer off the air, thanks.
Well, do you have an answer to that?
I think the tides are turning. There was a time in our country when any kind of political stance that could be perceived as being soft on crime was, you know, really political suicide. That could be the end of a politician's career. It was, you know, both parties were really sort of one-minded in terms of, you know, the kind of tough on crime legislation. And we saw incarceration in the United States rise about 400% since 1980 until 2010. You know, so there was a tremendous momentum toward, you know, toward that sort of violent response. And the winds are really shifting. There's a recognition that, and of course the United States now has the highest per capita incarceration rate in the world. We're 5% of the world's population. We incarcerate 25%. We have 25% of the incarcerated individuals in the world. And there's a recognition that this isn't working. And we know it's not working. You know, again, ineffectiveness. We know it's not working because the recidivism rates are so high. So, you know, if the idea is that this is some kind of punitive action, something that will happen and individuals will learn their lesson. Well, if we look at juvenile crime and juvenile incarceration, we see recidivism rates near 60%. So that's a 40% success rate of failure, you know, by any academic standard. And we're starting to see alternatives in the form of restorative justice, a movement that, a movement that has its roots in indigenous countries all over the world, but as a modern movement, didn't actually begin until after King's death. But we now see much better results in terms of all the sorts of things that we want to track.
What exactly is restorative justice?
So restorative justice is, again, the idea that instead of asking who did the wrong thing and what would be the appropriate punishment for this person, the question is what harm was done and how can we, the people involved and the community in which it happened, how can we repair the harm that occurred?
Yeah, and how does that lead to a more just and nonviolent society?
Well, it stops the cycle of violence. You know, I mean, when we incarcerate people, they serve their time and they come back out, their outcomes are incredibly poor. They have trouble getting jobs because they have, you know, if they have a felony, they haven't been in the world, and so they may not have, you know, familiarity with the new technology that's, you know, been developed. You know, they don't have the social relationship necessary to sort of navigate. So there are all sorts of things that make it harder for them to navigate through society, which actually increases the probability that they will again go back to criminal activity to try to sustain themselves, as well as the fact that when people are treated poorly, they become resentful, they become angry, and you know they feel like they may feel like society owes them something rather than wanting to reintegrate and be part of that community. And that's, I think, where restorative justice succeeds, where conventional justice fails. It brings people back and lets them make amends, lets them make things right, and lets them be contributing members of society.
I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with a guest about nonviolence and whether nonviolence is effective in bringing about social change. He says yes, and we are welcoming your questions, your comments, your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Mikhail Lubansky, who is a member of the teaching faculty in psychology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He writes the Between the Lines blog on race, culture, and community at Psychology Today, co-author of the book Toward a Socially Responsible Psychology for a Global Era. Our next caller is Mike in Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Good morning. Yeah, I want to take off a little bit on what Rich was saying. I think you need to have him on as a guest. He's very articulate. Mm-hmm. It's get the feeling he's got a wealth of knowledge, and he's reserved, not, unlike myself. NASA just released a report saying that we really don't have 30, 40 years. We have maybe 15 years at tops, the way things are going, before things become unbearable.
In terms of climate change.
Yes, you're correct. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about disease, famine, flooding, violent storms and such. And we're seeing it now. But how long are we expected to hold hands and sing Kumbaya and wait for the elite to give up their wealth and power and start to work for some kind of change? They're going to fight it. They've got the uniformed police out there all over the country. They're armored, and they've shown what they're willing to do. The police are getting more violent. There's more murders of citizens, unarmed citizens. We're seeing the NSA is, these people are getting very, very nervous, and they've got a trigger finger, and they want to keep up on all of us. I don't think if anybody rises up as a leader, they'll be taken down. I'm feeling that there may not be an alternative. So thanks for your time, though.
Well, how long can Kumbaya, fight this problem, Mikhail?
Well, I think the labeling of nonviolent resistance as gathering around, holding hands, and singing Kumbaya is really a myth. It's really the opposite of that. It's organized resistance. It's activism. It's boycotts. It's demonstrations. It's sabotaging covertly. It's basically everything and anything short of violence. And the types of challenges and the military that we face today is, not very different than what King faced in the 60s, and certainly not different than what Denmark faced when the Nazis occupied Denmark and wanted Denmark to turn over its Jews the way that they wanted every other country to turn over its Jews. Unlike most other countries, Denmark officially entered a state of cooperation and behind the scenes did everything they could to sabotage any requests coming from the Nazis, and in so doing saved probably over 90% of its Jewish population.
Thank you, Mike, for the call. Kieran in Howard is with us. Good morning.
Good morning. I know that the guest doesn't know about the rallies in Madison, but I was there for most of them. And I agree with him as far as the violence, and it puts a bad light on groups with violence. We were told, all during rallies to remain peaceful and things like that. But then when the Tea Party group came in, to see Palin, I think it was, they were, quietly trying to incite violence among us, which would then put a bad light on us. And also when Pat Walker was on the fake phone conversation with David Koch, and he thought it was Koch, he said, why don't you put some troublemakers in there to Walker, and Walker said he had thought about it. And then what would happen there is bringing the troublemakers and inciting violence, then it would put a bad light on us and really take away from our purpose. So, unfortunately, I know a lot of people think, the violence is the only way, but when you look at these things where, the fake David Koch, talked about putting troublemakers in,
Right. We can't go into all those details right now again, but I think she's getting at what about when nonviolent movements are sabotaged by people who want to, incite violence?
Sure. I mean, what I heard in her comments was the idea that nonviolence is so threatening to those in power that they're willing to resort to acts of sabotage, which if they became public would really be damaging, because the nonviolent resistance is threatening. So the way to disarm it is to try to incite violence and therefore take away its credibility.
Right. And so that's right. That's what she's saying. So I think she's saying that people those who were involved in this nonviolent movement were frustrated by this, and then the media portrayal of this, and maybe that's why people think nonviolence isn't all that effective because it's sabotaged.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of, I know when in the civil rights movement, the training for the young people who participate in the counter sit-ins, for example, was incredibly rigorous in the sense of making it very clear that they would be attacked, that they would be roughed up, and they were. They were pushed, they were shoved, they had ketchup spilled in their head, they had cigarettes extinguished on their body, and through all that, they were trained to remain nonviolent because the goal was not to overpower. The goal was to show the moral cause behind the movement.
Eric in Kenosha is with us now. Hi, Eric.
Good morning. I wanted to comment on this restorative justice concept because it is potentially so powerful. And one of the things that maybe didn't get mentioned was that in bringing the victims of a crime and the person who perpetrated that crime together in a way where they're undoing the damage, it can build a lot of empathy in someone who may not have empathy for the consequences of their actions. The drawback to it that I see, and I'd like to hear your guest comments, is that it can be very labor intensive. You know, we tend to look for short, simple answers for problems. You know, we have a problem, we lock it up. We have a problem, we lock them up. And it doesn't necessarily do any good, as your guest has said. But something like this can actually require a lot of people involved over a long period of time.
Maybe we can use our final minute or so here for you to talk a little bit more about the power of restorative justice and whether you think that's going to bring about a great deal of social change.
I do. I think restorative justice is the most significant nonviolent movement today. I think it has the potential to completely change the way modern societies address justice, not only in a criminal context, but also in the context of rule violations, disciplinary issues in schools, and spreading from that to just conflicts that we have with each other in the workplace and in the home. And in terms of time and labor intensive, well, yes, I mean, there's some preparation that needs to happen before people can come together for these kinds of dialogues. But overall, the process is incredibly more efficient than the current system, which has criminal cases that can drag out for months and months, if not longer, that take up the time of many attorneys, judges, and, there are so many more people involved. It's so much more expensive, not to mention that incarceration, I've seen estimates now in New York. In New York City, it costs over $150,000 a year to incarcerate a single person.
We'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us. Mikhail Lubansky is with the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's also the author of the Between the Lines blog on Psychology Today on race, culture, and community. Thanks to Robin Cherry and to Cynthia Schuster for producing and directing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.